This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 6:45 in the evening with Lynn and Ayman, and throughout this hour, we've been taking a look at the social aspects of the budget that was announced on Friday. As always, send us your thoughts if you would like to comment on Budget 2020, particularly in terms of how it's addressed women, youth, lower income groups, as well as people with disabilities, because those are kind of the four areas we're looking at. But anything you want to talk about, also okay. Call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. And now we're going to be looking specifically at social safety nets for lower income groups.
Yeah, so for that, we're crossing over to Christopher Chung, Deputy Director of Research at Khazana Research Institute. Chris, thank you for joining us on the show. What are your thoughts on how Budget 2020 addresses issues relating to the B40 group, and does it improve on our needs in terms of social safety nets?
So I think when we talk about social safety nets, at least in the international definition, there's always the protective and preventive type of strategy where you're helping the poor to move up to the poverty line, or you put in place strategies to prevent the poor from falling below the poverty line due to economic shocks. But there's also actually another strategy which is actually more promotive in nature, which is about getting more people to enter the labor force and to get jobs which are meaningful and are remunerated well and so on, as a way of strengthening their resilience and also human capital side. So I feel that Budget 2020 actually, in terms of social protection strategy, I think focuses a lot on the promotive side, I think, which is very needed for the country. In fact, I think there's also mentioned that they will expand coverage for those contract workers in the labour market through, I think, the EPF program in collaboration with FINAS. And there's also another expansion of the SOCSO from, I think, targeting the e-hailing riders now to, I think workers, self-employed workers in 18 more sectors. And I think this focus on the sort of the vulnerable workers in the B40 due to our shift towards a more digital type of economy is definitely needed, because work is getting more irregular, more non-standard. So these workers may not actually have the kind of traditional social protection like the EPF and SOCSO type of coverage. So I think expanding now the social protection to this group is quite timely. I think the only thing we need to monitor is whether in terms of take-up rate later on for this group, whether that will be sufficient or not. Because from what I know, some of these voluntary programs, the take-up rate is actually very low, because contract workers do not want to, you know, depart from their income and to contribute to these schemes. And I think the second one is also, eventually, I think we also need to talk about moving to some form of employer contribution to this group of workers as well. I think this is a discourse for later. But I think in terms of the B40 programs more generally, definitely, we have seen the existing programs strengthened. So if you talk about My Salam, PEKA, the targeted fuel subsidy, you can see that they have expanded the coverage and also the groups that are entitled to these programs. So I think that's also good. But I think the only issue is that because the B40 is such a large group of people, so those at the upper end of the B40, I think they share a lot of similar characteristics with those in the M40. So I think you will sort of create some sort of dissatisfaction among the M40 as well, as to why they are not, then why do they not have access to some of these social protection programs. Which is why our sort of report has actually come up with a new way to sort of demarcate the households, looking at both income and expenditure. And the way we have actually sort of proposed in the report is to look at it in terms of B20, M50, and T20. So in the sense that the B20 are those that are where we need to target welfare spending on, whereas the M50 are those groups that might need the more promotive type of strategies. That means helping them to integrate more into the labour market. But anyway, I wasn't expecting this budget to change the demarcation because I think it still requires more consultation, and that's something that we need to think about for the 12 Malaysia plan.
So what are your thoughts on the funds and initiatives then to close the urban-rural gap? Specifically, of course, Sabah and Sarawak are mentioned quite a bit in the budget for things like basic infrastructure, roads and transportation.
I think any initiatives that attempt to close the urban-rural gap or divide is definitely welcome, especially when it comes to Sabah and Sarawak. The whole urban-rural divide is also actually highlighted in the SPV 2030. So I think it is in line with the long-term thinking of the government. Even if you look at, say, the basic amenities survey, which have some of this data on spatial disparities, I think Sabah and Sarawak are still very much lagging in terms of water supply, electrification, infrastructure, and so on. So I think the focus on the allocation that's provided for water supply projects, rural electrification projects, and also rural roads are definitely, I think, definitely needed. But whether the allocation is enough or not, to what extent it can bridge the divide is something that we need to look at the end of the project implementation. And I also want to mention that actually in terms of the whole digital thinking as well, there's also actually allocation that's provided to strengthen broadband access using satellite technology to improve connectivity in Sabah, Sarawak. So I think this whole digital shift, so they're also putting in measures to ensure that the divide doesn't expand as we move towards this new economy.
And there's also the increase in minimum wage only in major cities from 1,100 ringgit per month to 1,200 ringgit. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the increase from 1,100 to 1,200, in terms of the cities, I think they didn't outline what these cities are. But for me, if you look at, say, the Belanjawanku, which is, I think, another, it's a reference basket that is calculated by EPF some time back, they show that for you to have an acceptable living standard in Kuala Lumpur for a single adult, you need about 2,700 ringgit. For a couple, it's about 4,500 ringgit. And for a couple with kids, on average, it's about 6,500 ringgit. So for me, moving from 1,001 to 1,002 is... it's definitely needed. I mean, it's not even near to the acceptable living standard that we are talking about. And it's also in line with Pakatan Harapan's manifesto to move towards 1,500 ringgit for minimum wage. But where I think there could be some concerns about, when you have differentiated minimum wage, that means cities get 1,200 ringgit, but non-cities get 1,100 ringgit, is whether it will create an incentive for people to move from the more semi-urban or semi-rural areas to the cities to look for a job or not. But I think for me, if you look at the cost of living in the cities, I think the cost of living is also a lot higher compared to some of the more rural or semi-urban areas. So if you take the real wage, I think the difference between 1,001 and 1,002 is not a lot. So for me, this is not something that I'll be too worried about at this stage.
Right. And we've also seen 25 million being allocated to expand and manage the food bank program. How well has that worked so far, and where can the money be spent to improve on it?
I must say that because there are not a lot of details on the food bank program as to how it is implemented and so on. What I do know from the budget speech is that it is 25 million ringgit and it's to deal with the 3 million tons of excess food which will be delivered to the B40 target group. So in terms of the sort of thinking and implementation, I cannot comment too much. But I think what I want to say is to what extent is this food bank program linked to other sort of similar type of food programs. For example, there's a lot of debate and discussion now about the school feeding program. There's also discussions about urban farming and so on, whether this is linked up to some of these existing programs or not. And I think second is whether beyond ensuring that the B40 has sufficient food, are we also looking at nutritious food for the B40? So when we're talking about these 3 million tons of excess food, are they also nutritious food that can be delivered to the community? And then my sort of last point on this one is whether, in terms of delivery mechanism, how do they want to ensure that the B40 in the more remote and rural areas will also have access to healthy and nutritious food.
So overall, do you see this as a budget that reflects the pivot towards our vision of shared prosperity?
Yeah, I think it is quite a challenging budget in the sense that it is the last budget for the 11th Malaysia Plan. Meaning to say that a lot of the existing programs that are already in this development planning cycle would have to continue because the allocation has already been given in previous years. So it's not something that you can not sort of change to a new program just like that. But on the other hand, it is also the last budget before the SPV 2030. and the 12 Malaysia plan. So they also need to sort of put in place some strategies to prepare for the longer term planning for the country. So for me, I think sort of given this context, I feel that they have done the balancing job quite well. And I think the whole digital part comes out quite strongly. And if you look at the SPV 2030, I mean, it's premised on the fact that we need to address the issue of premature deindustrialization in the country, to move away from commodity dependence and really to focus on technological upgrading with an emphasis on our SMEs. So I feel that the whole reindustrialization effort is really there with this budget. It gives the right kind of signal. And also on the distribution part, I mean, there are no new taxes in that sense, but they have also raised the taxes of those who have an annual income that is more than 2 million ringgit. I think it, again, sort of gives some indication that the distribution issues will be, I think, quite crucial moving forward. And I think the Budget 2020 has done a good job in that sense in shaping the agenda and the debates that need to take place when we move into the SPV 2030.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Christopher Chung, Deputy Director of Research at Khazanah Research Institute, specifically about how Budget 2020 addresses issues pertaining to the B40 Group and our social safety nets. If you have any thoughts on Budget 2020, send them through. Call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. So keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.